This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you own just one jazz album, there's a very good chance it's Kind of Blue by Miles Davis. And even if you've never bought a jazz album in your life, you've almost certainly heard this record at a party or in a movie soundtrack or playing over the loudspeakers in a restaurant. If you're a jazz buff, well, you know this record like the back of your hand. For our series on American icons, Ave Carrillo tried to figure out what it is that makes Kind of Blue so extraordinary.
When I was a senior in high school, one of my coolest friends gave me a cassette of Kind of Blue. I was already pretty happy with my Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush at the time, so it stayed in my glove compartment, along with about a dozen parking tickets. Months later, though, I finally popped the tape into my crappy car stereo. And for the next year, I listened to that album every single night. Sometimes I'd listen twice. 3 years later, I moved to New York City to study jazz piano. Kind of Blue is considered to be the jazz album. It's a symbol for everything jazz can be. It's hip, but it still draws from tradition, and it's avant-garde, but completely soulful.
Look, I don't think anybody in that band in that situation could even think that this would come to what it has come to.
The drummer Jimmy Cobb played on Kind of Blue, and he's the last musician alive from that session.
You know, we just figured we made a good record, you know, but we made a few good records, you know, so we had no reason to believe that this was going to be better than some of the other ones we made, you know, so who knows how that happens. I don't.
In 1944, Miles Davis moved to New York City to study at the Juilliard School of Music. He dropped out after only one semester, and 1 year later, he was playing in Charlie Parker's band. But pretty soon afterwards, the frantic sounds of bebop were starting to feel old. And Miles was one of the first to defect.
And the world is his oyster. I mean, everything is laid out right there in front of him. He can do whatever he wants. And so what does he decide to do?
Ashley Kahn wrote the book Kind of Blue, The Making of the Miles Davis Masterpiece.
Well, he goes in the totally opposite direction of where bop and post-bop jazz had been going.
Miles was thinking about a larger band, a slower pace and a much lusher sound. He started working with Gil Evans, a composer and arranger. They were still working with bebop, but also bringing in the influences of French composers like Ravel and Debussy. And the result was Birth of the Cool. And the style would come to be known as cool jazz. As Miles got farther away from bebop throughout the 50s, his trumpet playing was getting even more spare. Instead of fast runs up and down the scale, he would just blow a few carefully placed notes, and then he'd hold them. Miles started to record Sketches of Spain in March of 1959. It was his last album with Gil Evans. And in April of the very same year, he brought in his band to record Kind of Blue.
Take two, son.
Wait.
Okay.
Hey, when you raise up off this tube, man, you get... Oh, yeah. You know, your floor squeaks, you know. You know what I mean? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Let's go.
Here we go. Take two.
What do you remember about the recording session?
Nothing. I think I say it was normal. Recording session, the guys came out. I think I was probably first one to be there because I had to deal with the drums and, you know, with the engineer where they want you set up. But I understand the engineers had that room down to, you know, down to the nth degree. They knew exactly what the sound was in certain places, every inch of that place. Well, at least I got heard anyway.
In the Kind of Blue session, the tunes he had written were almost like his own trumpet playing. That spare, open sound he had developed, translated for a whole band.
Sketches that could have fit on a napkin, you know, was basically what he gave them to look at and said, now I want you to work over these scales, these chords, etc., and that's it.
Those little sketches on napkins were actually a revolutionary way of playing jazz. It was yet another movement started by Miles Davis called modal music. Think of it this way. It's like instead of painting with a tiny little brush, lots and lots of little details, musicians were given a big wide brush with which they could paint much more abstractly. If you had any direction for this tune, it was just like, okay, this is a medium tempo.
That's all.
That's it.
That's it. You know, usually they look at the drum and say, you'll hear it.
In 1958, Miles had met the pianist Bill Evans. Bill, not Gil Evans. And he fell in love with the crisp, sparkly quality of Bill's playing. And Evans introduced him to other classical composers like Rachmaninoff and Kachadorian. Ashley Kahn thinks Bill Evans was largely responsible for the music in Kind of Blue.
The whole idea for Kind of Blue came out of this relationship, which lasted only 8 months on the road, where Bill Evans was a part of the Miles Davis Band of 1958.
But arts critic Terry Teachout thinks this is something Miles Davis was looking for a long time.
He had had other pianists and fine pianists. I mean, Red Garland was a wonderful pianist. But it's quite clear that Evans played in a way that spoke to something within Davis and brought out a potentiality for a kind of simplicity and beauty that he'd never been able to realize.
Was certainly not the only important musician on the Kind of Blue recording. John Coltrane and Cannonball Adderley were both on saxophone. Bassist Paul Chambers was considered the best around. But for one song called Freddie Freeloader, Miles brought in a different pianist, and his name was Wynton Kelly.
Miles knew exactly what he wanted, and Wynton had what he wanted for this one. Wynton would be so much funkier. We got back to Wynton because that's the way we were feeling about it most of the time anyway.
Off the record, and maybe not so off the record, a lot of people say that the two piano players played to racial stereotypes. that Bill played like a white guy and Wynton played like a black guy. And audiences also weren't used to seeing an integrated band.
So, of course, Bill Evans was a little bit like a fish out of water with Miles's usual, you know, audience. And so he went through hell, you know, for 8 months.
We would go to places and people would be used to seeing Red Garland, you know, and they'd look and see Bill and say, whoa, wait a minute. There's something wrong with this picture, you know. So then he was feeling that too, I guess, for a moment, you know. And then in the band, Miles used to say funny things to him, like he was only kidding. You know, he would say funny things to him. Bill, you know, he felt funny about it, you know, because he didn't know whether Miles was kidding or not, you know.
What would he say?
I'm not going to tell you that.
Oh. Nobody tells me
that's
any of these
right.
stories. Why
you.
Is that? I don't understand. Is it because of my young years?
Yeah, that's
like,
what it is.
I'm
You're
too innocent.
Young. That's right.
I think I can handle it.
Yeah, but I don't know if anybody else can, so I'm going to leave that alone.
What Jimmy Cobb's getting at is that Miles essentially was a jerk. Not all the time, but often enough to keep people around him on edge.
You know, I don't like a comfortable person. You know, I can't be around them if they're just, you know, it's...
There was something about Davis's whole approach that was meant in part to make his audience feel a little uncomfortable.
Professor Gerald Early wrote a book called Miles Davis and American Culture. He thinks Miles' attitude was an important part of a persona he created for himself.
Particularly at the time, for a black man to have this kind of disdaining attitude towards his audience and this kind of sense that I don't owe my audience anything other than going out here and playing. I'm not going to be some kind of entertainer. I'm not going to tell jokes. I'm not going to smile. I'm not going to do any of that. I'm just going to play, and that's going to be it.
And Miles' persona was a brilliant marketing tactic.
Part of it was that he kind of took advantage of being both an insider and an outsider. He was, despite the way he presented himself, accepted by the white critical establishment. I mean, Miles Davis was a musician who made a lot of money. His music was very well regarded by the white critical establishment. But on the other hand, he still maintained himself as this outsider and as this rebel. And the fact that he was able to balance these two things for as long as he did in his career and make this music was really quite an incredible feat.
The combination of the drug-hardened, mean but brilliant musician was irresistible to Miles' audience, his black and white audience. In the 1950s, most black jazz fans were into soul jazz, artists like Les McCann and Jimmy Smith.
Kinda Blue was a bit of an anomaly because it sounded so different from those other kind of jazz records. But yet, all the black people I knew loved that record. I mean, they just loved Kinda Blue. It was a record that if you had it on you, it showed that you had taste. I mean, it was a record that seemed perfect in having a kind of intellectual veneer with being hip, with having a real sense of emotion to it. And people thought that if you like Miles Davis, that you were a young man who had intelligence and you were an okay kid.
In the 1970s, by the time Miles was helping to invent rock fusion, Kind of Blue was still cool. And when the writer Pearl Klug wanted to learn more about jazz, of course, one of the first albums she was given was Kind of Blue. And she listened to it on the way home to Atlanta.
And by the time I got to Atlanta, I was so in love with that music that I didn't play anything else for weeks.
But what could be ignored in the 50s and 60s, Pearl could not ignore in the 70s. She read Miles' autobiography, co-written with the poet Quincy Troupe. In it, Miles was unrepentant about his treatment of people. He shamelessly admitted to beating his wives and pimping in order to pay for drugs.
So I wrote the piece Mad at Miles because I was really angry at him for living the kind of life that made it impossible for me to listen to that amazing music and not think about what he might have been doing the morning he recorded that music. I tried to just forget about it, but that didn't work. I kept thinking about Cecily Tyson hiding in the basement of her house while the police were upstairs laughing with Miles. I wondered what she was thinking about, crouched down there in the darkness. I wondered if thinking about his genius made her feel less frightened and humiliated.
Miles has always been at the center of this debate. Should we look at an artist's life in order to judge the work, or should we just judge it on its own merits? That question will never go away, and it's probably why we're still fascinated by Miles Davis. It's that jarring contrast between the beautiful music and the hard, sometimes awful person who made it. But none of that debate explains how Kind of Blue became the best-selling jazz album of all time. What other album imparts hipsterism and in-the-knownness 45 years after it was made? In 1959, when Kind of Blue appeared, it was really just a blip in the jazz world. Because in that same year, John Coltrane recorded Giant Steps, what could be considered bebop's final statement. Also in 1959, Ornette Coleman played a 2-week gig at the Five Spot, and suddenly the free jazz movement was born. And again in 1959, Charles Mingus recorded Mingus Aum, signifying a new way for large jazz ensembles to play. The fact is, 1959 was an incredible year in music. And if you know jazz, you'll know every single one of those records. But if you don't know jazz, you can still get Kind of Blue.
It's like Shakespeare. Even if you haven't seen a Shakespeare play, even if you haven't seen Hamlet, you've heard a lot of Hamlet. And the first time you see it, you hear all the quotations in it. And Kind of Blue is like that.
My kids had zilch interest in jazz. I mean, they just thought, oh man, he's gonna come playing these, you know, these long, boring records. That was the one record that really clicked.
Even those ears that are used to the most avant-garde and experimental sounds of jazz, when they go back to this, they hear more and more.
It's not insistent, you know? It doesn't make you feel a certain way. It lets you feel the way you feel. It lets you come to it. And a lot of art doesn't do that. A lot of art doesn't leave room for you. And kind of Blue leaves room for you.
Kind of Blue inspired me to move to New York City to study music, just like Miles Davis had done. But I realized pretty quickly that I'm no Miles Davis. However, I did meet a nice jazz musician, and we're married now, so I have Kind of Blue to thank for that. For Studio 360, I'm Ave Carrillo.
You can find out more about Kind of Blue and all the American icons in our series, including Moby Dick, The Wizard of Oz, The Great Gatsby, and Barbie, at our website, studio360.org.